KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Hi, I'm Elvis Mitchell, and thanks for listening to The Treatment. Some of the most entertaining stories produced today, however, are not on the big screen, but they can be heard on KCRW's Unfictional. Intimate stories and artful documentaries crafted by some of the most talented radio producers across the world. Check it out. You can find Unfictional on KCRW's iTunes page. From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. I first fell in love with my guest, Jane Lynch, when I saw her playing Richard Kimball's only defender in The Fugitive, a movie that happened to be the film debut of Lester Holt, by the way.
Was it really?
He's the reporter in that movie.
And now he is gone to great heights. He's been on Hollywood Game
Night. As have you, as is my Emmy-winning guest.
Oh, thank you.
Jane Lynch, well, you may know, of course, from Glee, but she's now doing a cabaret show, See Jane Sing, which will be at the Annenberg on May 1st. And there's something about you that feels like so much of a self-starter. The way you work, it's often a way, that kind of moment of exuberance, the light that a performer gets in her eye just before they break into song in a musical.
I love that. I love that analogy.
But you know,
Thank you.
You know what I mean? I mean,
yeah.
That's clearly something that touched you as a kid, wasn't it? That sort of that moment of enthusiasm when everything's possible in performance.
But yes. You know, it's so interesting. I took a musical theater class in college by this man, Michael Berkson, who did not allow you to sing the song until you had spoken it as a monologue. And you had to get yourself to the point where the only way you could express these words is by singing. So he had – like this one girl did The Street Where You Live, which is a guy's song, but she did it anyway. And we were all in tears by the end of it. You know, how I've been here before. I've been on this street. But all of a sudden, everything's so light and beautiful and it's gorgeous. And you know why? Because she lives on this street. And exuberance, the word you use, the way she got into this song, it became a completely different experience than someone just, I have often walked down this street. So I love that. It's that moment that you go, I am going to – the only way I can express – what's going on here is I'm going to burst into song.
There's something about you that feels innately musical as a performer.
Oh, well, thank you. I take that as a compliment. I think I know what you mean.
But I feel like there's that quality of italicizing, of words, of lyrics living as emotion.
And yes.
Which makes sense in acting terms.
Yeah, it sure does. Yeah. Yeah, it does. Absolutely. Yeah, we're at that moment where you don't know how the person is going to express what's churning inside of them.
Sure, but I just wondered if music was always that big a part of you. You always thought in musical terms as an actress.
Yes. Well, do I consciously? No, not at all. But I'm sure it's in there because I'm innately musical. I always say I'm innately musical, but I have very little talent. I don't play anything.
Really? You're gonna sit across me and say that?
Well, I can sing. I can
Most
tell you that.
Most people know you from musical. This got to be great
That's
for you
true.
For this last decade of your life, where people think of you as a musical.
Well,
performer.
They do because of Glee. But you know, I didn't sing that much on Glee. But
you did sing.
I did.
Forgive
yes,
me.
Indeed.
I'm sorry.
I got to do some incredible things, especially the Madonna video and the Nicki Minaj rap.
Which was maybe one of my favorite things of all.
Thank you.
But even that becomes like an expression of character.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, it comes straight from it. And I think that's when it gets exciting, when songs and music. That's what I think Glee accomplished a lot during its run was the innately musical expression of feelings, especially, you know, these kids being in high school and, you know, kind of growing up. Although I think that one of the reasons Glee was such a big hit is that it's we're all still kind of in high school. You know, we still have that societal thing where we want to be, you know, the big, you know, man on campus, big woman on campus. So I think that's why a lot of people related to that. And when you burst into song, you know, it feels quite natural.
But, you know, Glee even for me kind of appends a little bit to the stuff you did with Christopher Guest because I think of you as this woman who's in love with a dog or that sort of thing where you have to find some place outside of your life to express something that means something to you.
Yeah.
And in Glee, it was that finding that inner life through the songs. But also these characters you play in those films, I hate going back to that word of liberation, but there's something, these moments where you just – your characters are often to me seem people completely free – in some part of themselves.
Yes. Yeah, I that is a great way to put it. You know, I like people of extremes. And Sue Sylvester was nothing if not that. You know, in Best in Show, Christy Cummings was so wanting to be special by being a winner. Nothing else meant anything to her except winning this title over and over and over again. And I created this thing that was cut out of the movie that she was really trying to make up for how horrible she was treated in high school, that nobody paid attention to her and everybody hated her. And she had these wars in her mind that didn't exist in real life, that just kind of were all lived in her mind. And this was her revenge. You know, at one point, and this is cut, but I say, I hope everyone in Romulus, New York, who's watching TV, seeing me win this, feels really bad that they weren't nicer to me.
Oh my God. Let's talk a little bit about the cabaret show. It's called CJ and Sing. Talk about how you put it together, yeah. Given that you have just proclaimed, and nobody's going to agree with you at all, that you have no musical aptitude whatsoever.
Well, I can't play an instrument, that's for damn sure. But I so appreciate music. It's the stuff that moves me to, like, spiritual experience. You know, it's the thing that where I kind of transcend myself.
The first musical that you saw that you remember doing that to you, what was that?
Funny Girl, the movie. You know, with Barbara Streisand.
Sure. What about Funny Girl? Did that?
Well, first of all, I loved the roller. I was very young, and I loved the roller skating scene, and I knew all the music because I was brought up with it. The Broadway soundtrack. My mother played it over and over and over, and I loved it. But where she sings in the empty theater, I add two and two, the most simple addition, and you know, Nicky Arnstein has left her. Oh, I know he's around. Oh, it's just so beautiful, and I remember just crying and. His is the only music that makes me dance. Yeah. What? And actually, she sang My Man, I Love Him So in the movie. I think they replaced that other one.
They did, yeah.
They did. But I love both those songs. But
because that's the difference between the stage show versus the movie. The song she sings in the movie is a much more kind of interior song.
Yes, indeed.
It's a much smaller number. Or yes. I should say much more intimate number.
It is a much more intimate number. And that I remember that just tearing me apart. I would sit and listen to that over and over again.
But did you like the brassiness of that show too? I mean, that's...
Oh, the broad comedy. Absolutely. I'm the Greatest Star. I used to lip sync that. And I understood that frustration.
Wow.
I am the Greatest Star and nobody knows... You know, and someday my mother's going to be proud of me. And that's exactly what Fanny Bryce's mother is like. You know, you'll be big one day and I'll be selling matches in the snow.
But this idea of what you're talking about with that professor who helped you to understand how lyrics work, mm-hmm. because they are expressions of emotion. They're not just doggerel. They're not just
poetry.
When it's
well done, it's a well-done musical, absolutely.
But talk about where CJ and Sing came from.
Well, let's see. I didn't think I wanted to go back to stage. I really did not have that hankering, and I know it's like kind of the cool thing to say, oh, I'm in television, but I really want to go back to stage. But I didn't feel that way at all. And then Broadway called me. And who says no to that? So I was offered Miss Hannigan and Annie.
What was that call like when you got that?
It was one of those things. My first thought was no.
Because
that's kind of how I roll. I always say in my head no, which I know is to say yes outside. Because I go back to my high school experience. I was cast in a play, and I didn't get a laugh at the first rehearsal, so I quit.
What was the play?
I quit. It was called The Ugly Duckling, and it was a condensed version of Princess and the Pea.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, you know it. And I played the king, starting a pattern of playing male characters. I didn't get a laugh in the rehearsal, and I quit. And it devastated me.
From not getting a laugh in the rehearsal?
Yeah. And what devastated me is that I didn't have the balls to go back and face it, even though I didn't feel like I was succeeding. I didn't get the laugh, so I quit. And I felt so awful about quitting. And the play went on without me. I was not I got a reputation in high school as a quitter. Never was cast until my senior year. And I suffered greatly at the hands of that one act. So I never say no anymore. Well, now I say no occasionally. But at that point when they called me for Broadway and my first thought was no, I said, hold on, Jane Marie Lynch. Why are you saying no? Because I was afraid. And I said, you call them back and you say yes. And so I did. And so that's what that was like. And I was thrilled to do it. I was so excited and nervous and it was the best.
But cabaret is, in its way, very much like theater.
Yeah, it is.
In that for the great cabaret acts are all about telling a story.
Mm-hmm.
They're all about an
emotion. We'll see what happens. I'm not really telling a story.
Okay, forgive me. Let me be more specific than that. Sorry, Jane
Marie. It's okay.
They're about delivering an emotional narrative that has a beginning, a climax, and a conclusion.
Okay, yes.
Right?
Right.
And you've got to do it. You build to your climax, mm-hmm. then you follow that.
And, yes, exactly. Then you denouement.
Oh, forgive my imprecision.
Yes.
But that's what you have to do in the act. And that must have been mm-hmm. of some appeal to you.
It is. I love – well, first of all, I love playing in a cage. So, you know, I like being free within some really well-defined boundaries. So when I started – let me go back to how I did this show. So I got the bite to – or the – you know, was rebitten by the theater thing. And then 54 Below, which is a cabaret space in New York, they asked me if I wanted 4 nights to do my act. And I said, I'll take those 4 nights, but I don't have an act, and I will create one. So I set about creating it. And that's how I came up with this show. And – it's extremely defined. It starts somewhere, it has the middle, and it has the end. And within
so it
that,
has an emotional narrative.
Yeah, it's
like
does.
A
it
structure.
Does. But one of the things,
I get to be right during this
interview.
You
are right, but let me just say, I kind of play on that in the beginning. I say, I explain how I chose all this music and that people told me that the muse would step in and you would get a theme. That's usually what happens. I've been trusting the muse all my life. This is going to make sense at some point. I'll just keep putting in honest work and, you know, working from my heart, and it's going to be something. Well, I said I got all my music together and no theme emerged. So I say, join me on a musical journey through a world of songs that have very little to do with one another. Except I like them.
Okay.
And all so right, it so does, but it's not like a meandering, crazy thing. It definitely has a narrative.
So where do you start? What song opens the act?
I open with this song called If Wishes Were Rainbows, So Am I, which was written by my friend Faith Soloway, and it's a power ballad that doesn't make any sense. It's almost like a Barbara Streisand song, to where it starts very soft, and she's telling a story, and then it talks about triumph, and, you know, but I'm kind of speaking nonsense through the whole thing. It's like the build is there, the cage is there, but the content is goofy. And my friend Faith Soloway wrote that. And then I do a song from a guy named Dave Frischberg.
Oh, jeez.
I knew you would know him.
He's which one?
Slapping the Cakes on Me.
Oh, man.
Do you know that song?
Yes, yes. So you got a trio, basically.
I've got a quintet.
Oh, that's cool.
So I got five.
Oh, my God.
I got five of them.
So you go from the power ballad to jazz.
Yeah, exactly. And Tony Guerrero is the band leader, and it's Tony Guerrero Quintet, and they become the lynch mob or whatever we call them for that night, for that hour and a half. But they're so talented and they're so wonderful. They're out of Orange County, and I'm so lucky that they want to do these shows with me and they travel with me, and it's just the best. So yeah, so that's jazzy and beautiful, funny words. You know, I mean, he's so clever, Dave Frischberg, and he's got a ton of songs, and I'm going to start looking at a lot of them because I'd love to put more in the act. And then my friend my friend Kate Flannery shows up. She was Meredith in The Office.
Oh, geez,
and she's
sure.
A good friend, and she's been weaving in and out of each other's lives for decades now. And she joins me on Mr. Monotony, which is an Irving Berlin song, kind of an obscure one that Judy Garland once sang in her show. And it's about a really boring guy. And it's really sweet, and it's a song I did on Glee that was cut. Ultimately, so
oh, gee,
I stole that arrangement. And
why was it cut from the episode?
Oh, he would cut, you know, cut a lot of songs. No, not a lot, but songs got cut, you know, unfortunately. It would run long. The show would run long, and he didn't like the way it looked at the end or whatever. So for whatever reasons, it was cut, but it was my game.
What was it about that song that you, when you first performed it, that made you like it, about Mr. Monotony?
First of all, it's in my sweet spot vocally. Okay. And it has a terrific – it's monotonous. It's a little dun, dun, dun. Da, da, da. And the band and the sax is just amazing. And then there's this really tight harmony. Kate joins me in the middle of it. She comes out on stage. And we do this really tight two-part harmony that is in her sweet spot, too. And it's just a great song to show off. But now, content-wise, it's about a guy who plays a trombone. And he just plays it really flat and monotonous. And a woman falls in love with him, and she becomes Mrs. Monotony. And then then a sexy clarinetter comes to town, and she goes off with him. So that's kind of the story of this poor guy who just can't keep a girl.
God, it sounds almost like it could be a song from the original Chicago. I mean
– yeah, yeah, I mean, like
Mr. Cellophane.
Mr. Cellophane, yeah. It's kind of like that. In fact, it's the structure is kind of like Mr. Cellophane. Dun.
Wow.
It sounds very – it's kind of monotonous and predictable, but really sweet in its monotony and predictableness.
This is what you get to say where you're doing the show here in Southern California.
Yes, yes. I'm doing it at the Annenberg Theater, which I have not been to the Annenberg yet, but I hear it's gorgeous. Have you been? It's supposed to be just beautiful. And May 1st. And just one night. We're so excited to be doing it in our hometown. We've been all over the country, so it's been – it's a great thing to come home and do it.
Well, take a breath. We're going to take a break. I'm Mr. Monotony. It's a treatment. I'm here with my guest, Jane Lynch. We're talking about a number of things, including her cabaret show, See Jane Sing, which will be at the Annenberg on May 1st. It's a treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
Immerse yourself in Rhythm Planet, hosted by Tom Schnabel, the world music blog and podcast dedicated to history, storytelling, and, of course, the music. Check it out now at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet.
Welcome back. I'm talking to a woman with innate musical ability. I don't care how she puts herself down, Jane Lynch. Many of you know her as Sue Sylvester from Glee. And I'm guessing one of the things that might have made you want to do a cabaret act is that it calls for a certain kind of vitality.
Mm-hmm.
And so much cabaret can border on the self-pitying. My guess is you want to sort of like
flip that over a little bit. We don't do it. It's not biographical at all. Not that that's a bad thing, but there aren't any tender moments where I shed a tear for my inner child. It's pretty fast-paced and funny, and we bring it down a couple of times, but even when we bring it down, it's still, I think, funny.
So how many songs are in the show?
I bet there's 11 or 12. And then Kate and my friend Tim Davis, who is the vocal arranger on Glee, joins us too, and he's a wonderful crooner, a really good-looking guy. Sounds so sexist, doesn't it, if he said that about the girl? She's a great singer and a good-looking gal. I mean, good-looking guy. And we do three-part harmonies together, and some of them are really – they're just so satisfying. Like, remember when I said I feel like music is kind of the religious experience for me? There are moments on stage singing with these two people where the three of us are going at it, and I just, you know, it's like I shoot out of my body some of the chords. Some of the music we make is just so beautiful.
Now, had you seen much cabaret before? Have you seen a lot of these shows?
I have. I've seen a handful of them, and I do enjoy the form. I don't like it when it gets biographical. Like one of the things I say at the start, I'm giving away all my jokes, Elvis. I say at the start, usually when a television actor wants to do a live stage show, it makes everybody within earshot want to put a gun to their head. Singing songs maybe they should have no business singing, telling stories that point directly to an unexamined life. So I'm going to spare you that.
My guest, who's clearly not saying you're never going to fall in love again in her show, is Jane Lynch. The show is See Jane Sing. It's going to be the Annenberg on May 1st. It's interesting, too, because I think a lot of people who come to know you in the last 15 years or so know you from these pieces that were, in effect, about competitions, be it Glee
or Best in Show or Mighty Wind.
Mm-hmm. These things, are, in effect, they're forces being pitted against each other. And I wonder if that's something you find that you respond to as well, that idea of being in these things where somebody sort of take a stand and say to themselves, I belong here and I'm going to compete.
Yeah, I think that is kind of what ran me, that kind of a thing, as a younger person. And it doesn't at all anymore. I don't feel a sense – I'm being as honest as I can. You can probably pick there and find something. But I'm not drawn to competition anymore or measuring myself against somebody else. I don't have even that in my consciousness anymore. But I understand that drive. And that's – when I first started playing the Christopher Guest movies and, Christy Cummings was – all of his shows are about people, reaching for the brass ring in order to, feel good about themselves and feel like they belong and that they matter. And I basically took that phrase, I belong, I matter, to be the undercurrent of that character, of Christy Cummings. And then it was a whole different psychology for A Mighty Wind for Laurie Boner. She had less of that kind of anxiety and that fueled her.
But I mean, for me, I will go back to the future because just remember that no, and I'm not going to tell you anything. But
wow, that goes back, yeah.
But even that idea of being sort of maybe not that case declarative, but certainly definitive, and somebody who knows where she stands, and these are characters that you played, this has to be part of the building blocks of the way you think your sort of performance philosophy, isn't it?
I think I think it's even psychological. It goes deeper, like a psychological thing, because if you were to ask me when I was about 30 years old, what do you stand for? I would make things up. Because I didn't know. I didn't know what I stood for. And I wanted to stand for something. Now I don't bother with that sort of thing. But I really did feel like adrift. I had like this existential angst. And so I loved playing people who knew exactly. Definitive is a great word. Like even the woman in Fugitive. I don't know where he is. But even if I did know, I wouldn't tell you. That kind of a thing. Yeah, definitely. Because I did not feel that way inside. But people looked at me and thought I did because I'm a tall woman.
But even if you're a tall woman, there's still this about you. And I wonder if this is something that goes back to you being a kid. You kind of have the physical confidence of an athlete.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can be a tall person and still be self-prepossessing. You can
exactly.
still shrink.
Yeah.
And there's nothing about the shrinking violet in you.
No, not at all. Not externally anyway.
Okay, yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Not, and so does that become a self-fulfilling prophecy where because of what people mm-hmm. see you as being, you get to become that in some way?
I think so. I think that it can be. As long as it's authentic, that's a great thing, I think. But if, you know, there are a lot of people walking around wearing like a suit of clothes that they don't feel right in. And that's how I felt as a young person. I have this kind of physique, this tall –
Statuesque.
Let's go ahead and say it. Statuesque.
I said it first.
I'll say it second. Okay. I second that. Statuesque kind of presence that people say, oh, this is a particular kind of woman. And then I would feel it. You know, and it didn't become an authentic thing until it really touches something real inside of you.
And when did it become authentic for you?
I think probably the journey started when I got sober. I was about 32 years old when things – I kind of relaxed into this life. Once I didn't have the addiction hanging over me, I started to relax into this body, this life with all these desires and these ambitions. And I think that started it. That definitely. And I think up until that point, I was kind of just unfocused and insecure and unconfident.
What was it like to act when you were abusing?
Well, you know, what's funny is I grew up as an actor in Chicago and we all partied.
Yeah,
and,
but also we should say about Chicago too, because I grew up in Detroit, not far from Chicago. Mm-hmm. And we would go see Chicago theater because there was a boisterous, competitive quality to Chicago theater.
Was.
I mean, it wasn't like Broadway or even off-Broadway, which is very much often these exploration of ideas. I mean, I saw Billy Peterson and John Malkovich in the shoving match
yeah.
on stage.
Oh,
I mean,
did you? Yeah.
I mean, so it was really –
exciting times, man.
It was really working class theater.
Yes.
I talked to Dave Mamet, who's been here before. We talked about
really?
That. There's
mm-hmm.
that sort of sense of – you have to belong.
Yeah.
And you have to prove yourself on a nightly basis. Mm-hmm. You have to prove it to the actors on stage, but also to the audience
mm-hmm.
who has worked hard and paid their money, mm-hmm. and they will be entertained.
Yes. And, you know, it's all self-starting, too. There are no Niederlanders in Chicago. It's, you know, Gary Sinise and Jeff Perry started that theater. And Terry Kinney, they started the Steppenwolf. William Peterson started Remains.
Thanks,
you know,
yeah.
they did it with – they cleaned their own toilets. You know, they did it for the pure love of expressing these wonderful works. You know, this – I mean, when you see a play at Steppenwolf, especially back in like the late 70s, early 80s, what an amazing time that was.
You could feel it. First of all, it didn't smell like a theater.
No.
It literally didn't smoke, which changes your experience, because I'd grown up going to see plays in New York when I lived there and just – taking the bus from Detroit to Chicago because the stuff was really cheap. That was also a great thing about it too. It was real working class theater.
Right.
You being a part of that theater, that kind of in some ways foster those insecurities because those people were really there because they were fighting.
Right. They were there because they wanted to be there.
Yeah.
You know, Chicago draws a particular kind of artist and it's kind of self-starters who are like, we're going to make this happen. You're going to do it with me? Great. And we're going to be better than this group and that group. Yeah, there is a competition there. And there's kind of a macho bravado even from the women, you know.
But also there was nothing elitist about it, as
no.
you were saying.
No, not at all. Like storefronts, you know, the Steppenwolf's first theater – well, the first theater was Highland Park, but the second theater was the Jane Addams Hull House on Broadway in the basement. You know, and now they, of course, have this beautiful
– Yes, this edifice there now.
Yeah, right.
This institution, this statuesque thing, like my guest, Jane Lynch, is sitting across me. Her,
nice seg.
You know what? I've been on radio for a couple of years now. Her cabaret show with C. Jane Singh, it's the treatment is going to be May 1st at the Annenberg. But I was just wondering, because you talked about being – not knowing where you fit and not fitting in. Was being in that place – it ended up being like this kind of crucible that sort of forced you to make a choice about whether you belonged in theater or not?
Absolutely. It sure did. Because that's kind of where I was able to – that was the one thing I knew about myself, that not only would I be unhappy if I weren't an actor, but I knew that I, quote unquote, deserved it. And so that was what got me up every day and struggle to an audition and get past the jitters and the fears and just show up, because it was something in me that knew I deserved it. I didn't think I deserved other things. You know, I was an unentitled, insecure person. But I knew that this was something I – not only needed to do but deserved to do.
It's funny as you're saying this, because I've got to think at a certain point when you were on stage, you really felt like you deserved it when you were on stage.
Right.
It was the moments when you weren't on stage that you weren't sure about.
Exactly. One of the things that when you're on stage, you're playing a role and people are forced to acknowledge you. Attention will be paid on stage. You know, they're forced to listen to you and they're forced to view you as because they have lines that they have to say with you. So I loved that part of the theater, because when I got off the stage, even though I wasn't, you know, I had friends and everything, but when I would get off stage, I was really insecure. I really didn't think people wanted me around. But when I got on stage, you're like in this false world that becomes very real for you, and I get to play a role in it, and I'm welcomed. That was big for me.
But I'm wondering, though, as you start getting cast in movies, did you feel that sense of belonging that you were talking about? Did you start to feel like this is something that not only you can do, but that you should do?
Mm-hmm. Really, I started to feel it with the Christopher Guest movies.
Because,
well, it's very few people does he deem worthy.
He does not suffer fools.
He does not suffer fools. You did a great interview with him, by the way. It was really wonderful.
I love him. I think.
I do, too. Yeah, that was really great. I remember where I was when I listened to it. It was a great interview.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was really good. And he doesn't give interviews very often, but I felt there was something about getting the blessing of Christopher Guest that just lifted me. They kind of inspired in me. It made my spine like crack into place, and it kind of inspired me to believe in myself. You know, because he would like look at me and go, "That was good." I don't think he ever used those words, but kind of that nod.
So if he said that was good, that's a real Dear Diary kind of a day.
Yeah, but there's something about getting the stamp of approval from somebody like Christopher Guest that'll get your motor running.
What was your first meeting with him like? Do you remember it?
Yeah, I did a commercial with him.
Oh, which commercial was it?
I did a Kellogg's Frosted Flakes commercial. He's a great commercial
director. He does a lot of commercials,
Anything you see on television that you laugh at, a commercial, he probably directed it. Yeah, I was called back for this commercial, and then it said it, in the sign-in sheet, director Christopher Guest, and he was in there. And I had seen Guffman. Guffman changed my life. It really did. I was like, that's what I want to do. That's how I want to work.
Wow.
I want to play those people.
Because it must have felt to you like that kind of Chicago theater we're talking about.
Yeah.
That sense of
that
of
ensemble,
yeah.
And it was about theater. You know, Waiting for Guffman was about theater, and these people who are reaching again for the brass ring, you know, they think they're going to go to Broadway, and maybe they're deluded or whatever, but their aim is true and they're devoted to this. And I loved it. I loved that movie. I thought everybody was hilarious, and they were just off in just such a way that was so real. They just created these really real, simple, lovely people.
Yeah,
you know?
They weren't caricatures.
No.
They weren't sketch characters.
No, they were so – everybody had their own thing. You know, it was just so good, and everybody was good. So he cast me in the commercial, and it was a great experience. And then about 2 months later, I was at a restaurant in L.A., and he came in for breakfast, and he said, "Oh, I forgot about you, but I'm casting another movie. Why don't you come to my office?" So I went to his office, and we were just kind of sitting across from each other talking about – you know, kind of painfully because he's not a big conversationalist. But there was something very – I felt very safe and calm and like I didn't need to talk in his presence. For a while, we kind of just looked at each other and kind of smiled. And he says, I can tell if somebody can do this work like within 30 seconds. And so I didn't say, "Oh, can you tell I can do this?" I didn't ask. And then he said, "So anyway, do you know Jennifer Coolidge?" And I said, "I do, and I think she's wonderful." He said, "Well, we're looking for her partner in this, and I think you'd be good. I want you, I want to talk to Eugene tonight, Eugene Levy, and I'll give you a call." And so he gave me a call, and I was in. And I jumped up and down. Oh, I was so happy.
Has he seen the Cabaret show yet?
No, he hasn't. I'm doing two of his songs, too. So
Which songs are you doing?
I'm doing Blood on the Coals from the Folksmen and The Skeletons of Quinto, which is a Christopher Guest special.
I can't wait to see the show, and I can't thank you enough for doing it. And you have to find a reason to come back, Jane. Thank you so much for
doing
this.
Oh, I would love it. I'll get you a couple tickets.
Well.
I'm in the know. I'm hooked up. I'm connected.
We have to make sure we don't say it's too loudly. That may be payola. My guest is Jane Marie Lynch.
Yes.
She's starring in See Jane Sing at the
Annenberg Theater in Beverly Hills on May 1st.
Okay,
8 o'clock curtain.
Good. Well, get your tickets. I can't thank you enough for doing so. Recording engineer who also mixes the show is Melissa Morton. It's edited and produced by Jenny Radelet. Of course, I'm Mr. Monotony. It's The Treatment. To catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.